whenever we are meditating or when we are truly meditating, we are diving into that nothingness, and you know, where thoughts cease to exist, that's the desirable state, right, where you feel that peace or bliss and that calmness so much that you are just observing things as they are. You become the spectator, you leave this identity, and you are sort of just watching your own thoughts, your own, let's say, whatever is going on physiologically in your body, and you just become that observer,
right?
And so that, carrying that state into your normal routine,
right?
I want to ask, like, is that more desirable, to be just observant all the time, versus having an affirmation or a chant or a japa on in your mind, which does clear or purify the mind, but on a more superficial level, it doesn't go to the roots of our vrittis or, you know, tendencies of desires and cravings and aversions. It does not really take them out from the root, while meditation does that, or observing and going deeply into yourself helps you, sort of when you observe it, it ceases to exist.
Well, I would not give so much power to observing your thoughts. I don't think observing your thoughts necessarily does anything to eradicate them. It may make you self-aware. It may allow you to be less reactive. But I don't think observing your thoughts in and of itself actually changes them. It changes them only to the extent that if you're not quite so caught up in them, so you're not reinforcing those tendencies so strongly. I think affirmation actually does more to shift your thoughts than merely observing them, because it's redirecting the energy in a more positive way.
But how deep does the affirmation go versus meditation? Let's not say just observing thoughts, actual meditation and affirmations.
Well, in as much as we can't meditate all the time, that we're going to end up having to participate in life, the question then becomes how best spiritually to use the time when we're not meditating. That's really the question. If I'm not just sitting in meditation and I'm having to go about my business, what is the best way to be? Now, this whole idea of what they sometimes call mindfulness, which I really have never studied or practiced it in, so I'm not certain what it is, but observing what's happening, it can't really be criticized as a practice. It's a valid practice. But it's not entirely consistent with Master's teaching, nor is it, to my mind, the most effective teaching, because it's the principle of just observing, to a certain extent, comes out of a tradition. Now, I may be a little bit off here, but this is how I understand it. Comes out of a tradition in which devotion to God is not so central. You know, it's more Buddhist by nature. And one of the things that the Buddhists pride themselves on, I'm not sure the Buddha prided himself on it, but Buddhists now pride themselves on, is they're not devotional. And they're not thinking about God. They're being detached and they're observing. But with Master's path, we have a much more, really in a sense, a dynamic involvement of a higher power. And we're not so passive. We are concentrating on the presence of God. We are pulling the presence of God in. We are thinking about not merely observing neutrally, but transforming ourselves. So from that point of view, to be constantly affirming and lifting our energy in a positive direction is more, whether or not you would even say it's more effective, it's more consistent with what puts us in tune. Let me just get one more piece of that. when you have God as, or Guru, as the object of your devotion, you're always trying to create something. You're not trying to become nothing. You know?
Isn't yeah? that creating something, a figment of your imagination?
No.
You're trying to, you know, the mind has the ability to project what you continuously think about, and you can make it manifest in your meditation because you can. But is that really a true experience, a direct experience, or is that just something you manage to create out of your mind's ability to
right. It's a very good question. That's the difference between mere visualization and attunement. See, the whole point of Master's path of self-realization as he teaches it is the presence of the divine is there. We're just not attuned to it. Like a radio in this room, if it's not turned on and the dial isn't set, we don't know that the radio program is in the room, but if we turn on the radio receiver and set the dial, suddenly we'll realize that the radio wave was always in the room. We just weren't receiving it. So the awareness of the divine, the positive potential of our own nature, the bliss nature of our consciousness, all of that is really there. We don't realize that it's there. So when we're using imagination to project, as you're describing, a certain state of consciousness, we're using imagination to project us to meet it. We're using our imagination to tune our radio, but when we tune our radio, something that is beyond our imagination comes into us, and it becomes real. Now, some kinds of visualizations are just imagination. I'm walking through a green field, and then there's a wonderful waterfall, and a white unicorn comes in. And you can make yourself, you know, feel relaxed, even cheerful, but that's imagination. When you say, I am one with the Infinite Spirit, Divine Mother, come and bless me, Divine Mother, make me an instrument of your love, you're using imagination, because you may not necessarily feel it, but you're using your imagination to attune you, and then at a certain point, you're lifting up and grace is descending and you meet. And it's no longer a product of your own mind. You just got yourself to the point where the reality comes into you. It's a very important question you're asking, and a huge and subtle difference. And it's one of the many reasons why when you start on a path, it's really good to stay with it, because you throw in other things that seem like these are good teachings too, but you're off and you don't realize you're working against yourself. It's confusing, because Master's path recognizes the validity of all paths. At the same time, we do better if we concentrate, especially until we have enough experience to be able to discern. But all masters, and our master too, encourages us to be one-pointed in our devotion. Does that make sense? Yeah, very good question. Yeah. Narayan, how nice to see you.
I have a question.
Okay.
It's not a very good question, I'm sure.
It's okay. So we'll have one good one and one bad one. Okay.
Yeah. You know, some of us, because of the kind of jobs we do,
yes,
we are not able to give time for meditation, in quite a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a fixed hours job, then you know, getting up at this time and you go into meditation at this time. But there are some jobs which are like, including the job I do, you know. So in the process, you miss doing meditation. Of course, I do miss it. When I don't do it, I feel, you know, it's bad. How does one overcome this?
By not giving up. That's the only thing I would say. You know, some people have regularity. It's just their nature. They can set systems. They follow their systems. Some people's jobs encourage it, but sometimes it's just a matter of temperament. I have a temperament that just, it's all over the map. I'm never, it's hard to be regular. And if that's your life circumstance or your temperament, you just figure that saints are made out of all kinds of people. And the most important thing is just, I like to say to people, just be a person who's committed to meditation, and you meditate, I say, regularly. And whether that regularly is every Sunday morning or every morning and night without fail, but that it's a regular, you consider yourself to be a person who's committed to this practice, and no matter, you make the rhythm longer than 24 hours. So that even if you're not regular in every 24 hours, you're committed and you're regular in the sense, just like you said, if I stop doing it, I miss it. Our lives are not conducive to an inward life. We're always having to fight against the tendency to go outward. It's the nature of the times that we live in. And I just assume that God knows that. It's much more important to be optimistic and positive and confident about your spiritual life and your relationship with God than it is to meet any standard that's laid down. Because you need to feel that you're part of this and you're doing it, and not always feel like you're failing at it. Because if you think you're failing at it, where does that take you? You know, especially if your job or your family responsibilities or your health or your habits, you just keep pushing against it. And, you know, also different astrological periods, different stages of life, different karmas, they play themselves out. I've watched myself over many years. Sometimes everything is in order and it works really great. Sometimes everything is a struggle and it doesn't. And you just have to not quit. I mean, success is not quitting. It's odd because we think success is striding, you know, perfectly in, carrying the banner, having... But actually, after all these years, I think success is not quitting. I've seen people who looked like heroes who just fell by the wayside, and some of those who just were always the last in the line, but they're still in the line, and they've been much more victorious. So I think that's an important way to think about it. Fair enough. And a friend of mine once was being really unpleasant. She was being very unpleasant to our whole group of friends, and I was appointed to find out why she was so consistently in a bad mood. So she told me that she was upset because her meditations were going badly, and she wasn't meditating as much as she wanted to, so she was moody all the time. I laughed and I said, when my meditations go badly, I feel like I have to be really, really nice because I have to make up for it by being really good everywhere else. But think about it like that. If one area of your spiritual life isn't flowing as easily, then try to make everything else compensate for it. That's why I'm saying it's better to feel confident and successful than it is to feel ashamed or like you're failing, because what good will that do you? So you're not meditating as much as you should, but you're being very serviceful, you're being even-minded, you're being cheerful, you're keeping the presence of God, you're praying, you have faith. Of course, that will all eventually help your meditation. And it will also make you, instead of like my friend, well, since I don't meditate well, now I'm just going to be unpleasant in every area of my life. Where is that going to take us?
Yeah. I have a question. It's something that you said the other day also. It's like you're wearing a stone for an astrological reason, and when it doesn't suit you anymore, it falls off. You know, you don't need it anymore, so it automatically kind of goes away from you. And you just mentioned some astrological reasons right now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you is it really believed that these things have an influence on how we think or how we behave? I mean, the stones we wear, or believing in astrology. Is it believed that this does really happen? They do have an influence on us?
Well, Master writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, and he himself expresses skepticism, and then he tells us that Sri Yukteswar himself recommended it. Sri Yukteswar is about as austere an image of a spiritual person as you can imagine, who would be the least inclined to be either superstitious or superficial. So there's many things that when you accept, for example, that Yogananda is truthful and is a true master, and if he says things that we can't verify, the chances of him being right are greater than the chance of my being right. So a certain amount of, I'm accepting this because if I know that this is true, I have no reason to say that this isn't true, even if I can't say independently. Now, there's a lot of remarkable stories about the power of astrology. I'll just tell you one, although you know many. A friend of mine who is actually Indian, who's from South India, although he lived in Canada and the United States, he was a very well-to-do man and in America, living in America, and someone in America, a national profile case, a man was arrested for some kind of financial fraud. The man who was arrested and seemingly guilty had a very peripheral relationship with my friend and his company, but it was enough to launch an FBI investigation of my friend that in the end completely ruined him financially. For 2 years, he was under absolute assault. In the end, he had to just simply let go of his whole company. Just everything came to pieces, and he was completely innocent. You know, these things happen. Just before the end of that 2-year cycle, he found a horoscope that had been done by a friend of his grandfather in the Tamil language when he was born, and it had been translated, and he hadn't looked at it, you know, forever. It said at a certain age, which exactly corresponded, he will be persecuted by the government, and it will last for 2 years, and it will end on his birthday right here. The case looked like it was going to go on forever. 2 days before his birthday, the government suddenly reversed itself, dropped the case, and on his birthday, it settled. I mean, it's like, how do you figure that? Now, my understanding of what astrology is, and I'm no astrologer, I know almost nothing. I know a little bit more about the chakras, and I know that in the esoteric system about the chakras, every chakra has a ruler, has the planets, and so on. So what you're looking at when you're born is you're looking at the external manifestation of the karma that's in you. And it's even scientific now that there's no point of separation in the universe, that if the universe is a field of energy, then that means that energy at this end is going to affect energy at that end. And even just looking at our own lives, if you try to take any piece of your life and just draw a closed circle around it, you absolutely cannot do that. A woman wrote saying that she'd never believed in karma, and then she was talking about holding her baby grandchild and the child sneezed in her face, and then a few days later she came down with the same sniffle that her grandchild had. Because she had this sniffle, she became seriously ill, then she had to cancel an important engagement, this whole cycle went. So she started backing up as to how she happened to be standing there holding her grandchild. Of course, before there could be a grandchild, there had to be a son. Before there could be a son, there had to be a husband. Before there could be a husband, there had to be his parents. Before there could be his parents. And, you know, you can go all the way back to the creation of the universe, and you can't ever cut it apart. And if we think of it as not material but as energy, I mean, just you throw a stone into the pond and the ripples move, and they just keep moving. So the thought that there are subtle forces at play, which could be personified or actually emanating from the planets, is not at all unreasonable, and that there could be subtle relationships between the emerald that I wear and the planet that it represents. It's not unreasonable to think so. And even if I can't quite understand it, the evidence just keeps coming, and it keeps coming, and it keeps coming. And I have a certain sensitivity to things, and I definitely cannot feel the relationship between the stone and the planet. But I can certainly feel the power of the stone. And what I was commenting on the other night was I used to wear three, but the third one never did anything for me. And it may not be that I didn't need it, or that was so, or it was just that stone was not the right one for me. I mean, that literally, that stone, not that kind of stone, but that stone. But I just never liked it, whereas these two I have always loved. The same astrologer recommended them all. His explanation, actually, now that I remember it, I think it was also the wrong stone, but it was a white sapphire in lieu of a diamond. And he told me, I don't think you can have a substitute. He said, you're a gal who needs a diamond. Not being able to afford a diamond, that's just too bad. I'm just not going to wear it. But also, I think it was the wrong stone. After that, I can't say. I'm sort of willing to experiment. So, I mean, you know.
If I have visited an astrologer, mm-hmm. People say, you know, how can an intelligent person go to visit an astrologer? I mean, you know, how do you believe in these things? And then the astrologer, of course, would recommend you wear a stone. And then they'll say, you know, you think that stone is going to do something for you. So it was just a question that because I do sometimes consult an astrologer.
Yeah.
Do wear a stone if he tells me to. But I'm not very sure whether that really helps me or doesn't help me. But yeah. There are things, like you say, they do tell you which do materialize in that sequence.
Yeah, I can't say that the stones actually help me, but I do say that I like them. They give me energy. And the fact that I didn't like the other, I find interesting. I wear this, which Master also recommended, the gold and the silver. What I find interesting, this is another just speculative side of it, is pure metals, you know, real gemstones, they emanate, let me phrase it differently, you know, in higher ages when people were more sensitive to these things, you know, they could feel that these things had power. That's why people of power wear gemstones, you know, like a crown and they carry gold and so on. And it isn't really a sign of wealth. It's that there's actual energy and power in these things. And so a person of power would want to have, it would amplify his own power. I think these are memories of higher ages, and that's why they retain their value. Because they actually they have sufficient life force to generate energy. I mean, like the carpet doesn't generate any energy, but a crystal does. It's the Swamiji said the crystals are the dividing line between living and non-living. They're the transition point. That's why Master spoke of remembering back to being a diamond. I don't know where gold and silver come in all of that, but it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. Actually, if you had attended the first class, Asaji had said that. Yogananda Ji had a diamond. He saw life in the diamond. You look at it more as a life rather than. So, a life automatically it gives some energy.
Swamiji, in Paris many years ago, there was a display of crystals that were as big as furniture, really big. Swamiji went to visit that. I never saw it. He said it was so interesting. He said you were in the presence of living creatures, but who had a most unusual consciousness, is how he described it. You know, just visiting there, it was more like a zoo than a museum. they were alive, but their vibrations were just very, very different. I saw a documentary of this cave. I think it's somewhere in Mexico. Maybe you've heard of it. It's under, like, there's a silver mine. There's a mountain where they're mining some metal. And they drained water out, and they discovered this cave with crystals, beautiful crystals, as big as buildings. And so you can look it up probably on the internet. There's a documentary film of the people going in and with these gigantic crystals. It's very, very hot. So it's hard to explore. You can only be in there for a short time. But even in the pictures, you could feel that there was somebody there. Just really, really remarkable. That's subjective, you know, that's my own intuitive feeling, but it's supported by Master's words in the autobiography. So who can say? But Master, simultaneously, it's also important, also in the autobiography, he completely defied his horoscope. And he burned it to ashes when his family told him he had to marry because it was destined in his horoscope. He just burned his horoscope and delivered the ashes to his family. And Swamiji said sometimes Master would get an astrologer to tell him the least auspicious time to do something, and then he would deliberately do it, both to prove that we are not to prove that man's willpower is stronger than anything. But it was more difficult to accomplish during that period of time, but he wanted to show that you could. So you don't want to be a slave. I also think astrology is one thing. The astrologer is the key, because some astrologers are very good and some are terrible. And a terrible astrologer, even a mediocre one, is really not useful to you. And it's not merely a question of how intuitively they can interpret the information. It's also a question about their own orientation toward life. Because an astrologer can give you the illusion of being wise, but he may merely be knowledgeable, which is quite different. So you want an astrologer who's not only knowledgeable, but also wise. Fortunately, within the context of Ananda, there is at least one man who is like that, who's a deep devotee of this path, also very good at astrology, but all of his advice is oriented toward what's important to us. And so he reads the horoscope in such a way that it takes you toward divine realization, toward attunement with Master, rather than the opposite. His prejudices are in our favor.
I think what you mentioned earlier, you know, to the friend, the Tamil thing, uh-huh. That is the Nadi astrology, uh-huh. The ancient Tamil astrology, which quite a few people, Ananda, have consulted in Gurgaon.
Oh.
I know even Dhyanaji has gone,
uh-huh.
Not long, you know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's actually a very fascinating aspect of astrology. I'm sure you know about it. Nadi astrology.
I went to a Nadi astrology.
Oh.
He was so eager to... I'd been watching this misery that he'd been living through very bravely, I must add. He lived through it very bravely and started a new company in his back, you know, back on his feet already. But he went, especially, but it really helped him, actually, to just read that and, like... And then it was a miracle, exactly on the moment. It also makes you think, why do I ever worry about anything? You know, our hands, our lives are in the hands of God, and if we accept it bravely, then we live through it. It's fine. If we accept it, if we suffer, it's going to happen anyway. Although Master said even karma doesn't happen the same way for a devotee because of the grace of God. The masters can always intervene. So Swamiji's predictive for his life was to end in 2009. I mean, that was the Bhrigu reading, that was pretty much everything. And in 2009, He came very, very close to dying. He was in Gurgaon at the time. And when that birthday started coming, he was supposed to die right around his birthday. I mean, it wasn't like it was an ironclad, but it was just sort of, and that was the age about his parents died. It was just sort of there that that was going to happen. And I made a point of coming to India, which I probably would have done anyway, because if it was his last birthday, I wanted to be there. And the day after his birthday, were you all there? Yeah. And they were having that play for him, celebrating his birthday. And right in the middle of it, he had some kind of a seizure. He didn't say anything, but he had a seizure, like a heart attack or a brain. And he became very unwell. I mean, he really went right to the edge. He was supposed to fly to America the next day. America? Europe the next day. And he couldn't button his shirt. He couldn't lift a spoon to his mouth. He could hardly talk. And it went on for a number of weeks. It was a big question as to whether or not he should travel. But historically, whenever he was shifting continents to go to do work in another place, very often there would be some force that would try to stop him. So in the end, Miriam, his nurse who made those decisions, decided that he should go. So we did fly, but for quite a few weeks. Well, his birthday was May 19th, and it was the first or second week in June. He was still very, very debilitated, and his nurse, he could have died from three or four different things, and he was not getting better. I could tell you the exact date, but I can't remember it right now, but I think it was somewhere the first or second week in June. And we were having, he was never alone. There was always somebody with him. I mean, not merely in the house, but in the room or within the next room. And I was on duty. And for some reason, he either woke up from his nap, or I think I had to get him up because somebody was coming. And he was in bed, and he couldn't put on his own shirt. You know, I've taken care of elderly people. You have to help them get the arm in and button up the shirt. And I was making light conversation with him, and I chose the shirt, so I chose a beautiful blue one. He was still wearing orange then. And I said, Swamiji, you know, if blue were the color of sannyasis, then you would wear it all the time. Orange is not nearly as nice a color on you as blue. I mean, just trivial conversation, buttoning his shirt. And I said, we should change the color of sannyas from orange to blue. I said that to him. He said, I'm thinking of doing that, like that. And then I helped him into the living room. He stretched out on the couch with his feet up. It was sort of a short couch. And he just lay down there, and I went back into the bedroom to fix the bed and put things away. I came back out into the bedroom, the living room. He was lying on his back with his hands like this, absolutely still. And I thought, well, he's died, and I'm the one. You know, I was right here when he died, meaning it was my responsibility, and he died. I turned my back on him, and he died. And I was more than a little alarmed, but, I mean, he was supposed to die at this point, so maybe he had. And I walked over to him, and he started talking to me. And he started talking about founding the Nayaswami Order. And he sat up, and he started talking to me about it, and he said, now, I don't remember right at this moment whether he told me then or not, but he said, this is what Satan was trying to stop by taking my life. He said, but Master wants me to live longer so that I can do this. And either in that moment or later, he said that he felt himself going, and that I don't want to say it differently than he did, but somehow we all felt that Master came to him. But Swamiji did describe it as he was at the edge of having a choice of living or dying. And he was perfectly willing to go either way. It didn't matter to him. Master gave his life back to him so that he could found the Nayaswami Order and write the Patanjali. Because, you know, he passed away 4 years later. He lived four more years. But by that night, I mean, he couldn't button his own shirt. And 2 hours later, he's sitting at computer writing a book, a renunciator for the New Age, putting us all in blue. That evening, he had a meeting at his house. Just like that. Because karma doesn't work the same for a devotee. And we all felt that the last 4 years, he felt too. That was his appointed time to die. But Master had a little more that he wanted from him. So he went those last extra years.
He was very good in Sanskrit. He could write a very good piece of Patanjali.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sanskrit.
Good in Sanskrit?
Yeah. Oh, was he good?
Swamiji.
Only slightly. He didn't.
But it was so deep when he read it.
But it was not. It was a gift from Master. It was Master's intuition through him, not being able to read the Sanskrit. He didn't need to read the Sanskrit. He was able to commune with Patanjali through Yoganandaji, and that's how he knew it. He wrote that book so fast. He wrote everything so fast at that point. He just would sit down, and he just knew. He just went right through it.
Uh-huh. How did he learn Sanskrit? How did he...
He didn't need to. See, we think you need to...
I think I try one word, first I have to learn, then...
But he didn't need to, because Master spoke to him directly. Yeah. But he knew a little, but he didn't understand it because he understood Sanskrit. He understood it because he understood truth. And because he was so attuned to Master. He many, many years before, 1990, when he wrote The Essence of Self-Realization, The Wisdom of Paramhansa Yogananda, you must have that here in India. He wrote that book with a pencil, whereas normally he wrote on a computer or with a pen. But he wrote that book by hand because... He said the computer was too, it interfered. He needed to be able to hear and feel Master like that. So he wrote it mostly with a pen, he wasn't even in his own house, he was sitting in a different house very quietly. And after he finished writing that book, he said, and that was now 23 years before he died, he said he couldn't tell the difference anymore between his own thoughts and Master's thoughts. That his consciousness had merged so completely with Master, he didn't have a separate identity from him. So when he would sit to write, it was Master's inspiration right through. He used the Bhagavad Gita as the most astonishing example of that. Because he just remembered, he wrote Master's interpretations, and he wrote the whole book in 2 months. I mean, that's the kind of book that would take a person 5 years to write. He wrote it in 2 months, and as he described it, because many of us were there, he had a constant stream of house guests through that period of time, and then he would just write early in the morning or late at night. He would write that book, and then he would put the new pages on the coffee table. Literally, he wrote faster than we could read. You know, we didn't have enough time to read his pages, and he had time to write more of them. But he said it was just because Master was just telling him. And so he knew what to say.
Incidentally, the lady who translated his Essence of Bhagavad Gita into Hindi, mm-hmm. her name happens to be Asha Lata Chaudhary. Mm-hmm. So she said that she has never come across such a good Sanskrit scholar ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Reading his Imagine, she didn't know him, but she...
Oh, isn't that interesting?
She's never seen such a great Sanskrit scholar ever.
Hmm. Well, I think that the source of that went on the other side of Sanskrit. The ones who created Sanskrit are the ones who were giving him the answers. Patanjali, go ahead.
One more very personal thing. Swami can read minds, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He was reading minds.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to happen very often with me.
Yeah.
That is...
Yeah. I certainly found that he seemed to know what was going on.
Everything he was...
Yeah, he always seemed to know. He always seemed to know.
Why does it so?
You know, it's interesting because Shika, yes, asked a question earlier, how the masters have such fine intuition, how can we have that kind of intuition? The reason intuition is to know something directly because it's your reality. You know where your hand is because you're in your hand. You know where it is. I don't know where Keshava's hand is because I don't identify as deeply with him as I identify with myself. But the more elevated a soul's consciousness, the more he identifies with all of creation, and the less he's specifically defined by the body he lives in or by the personality he has. And then he knows you as well as he knows himself, because he sees you as himself, and he's taken down the barrier that, I mean, all of us bridge that occasionally. You know, the phone rings and you know who's calling. You suddenly feel that a friend needs your help. Something happens where we unify. So we know it can be done. But Swami just simply, he had trained himself to transcend his own reality and to be in all realities at the same time. And then he would just look at you and you would be him as much as he was himself. I've certainly saw him. I mean, it got to be a joke between us sometimes when he would say, there was a particular time, "How are you, Asha?" "I don't know, sir. How am I?" "I don't want to tell you. Why don't you tell me?" And on occasion he would say, "I think you're fine." And on more than one occasion he said, "I'm a little concerned about you." I said, "Me too." You know? Other questions?
How are the talks going? Fine?
Very nice. Very nice, yes. I mean, all this week?
Yeah,
really good. Wonderful.
So since the karma of a devotee is different, unlike normal people, Vitriya, and he works by self-effort and draws grace, between grace and self-effort, which is more important in his life? And you know, because we talked about you have to make that effort to meditate more regularly, and I feel that yes, we need to also keep ourselves attuned to that grace all the time, whether we are able to make that self-effort to meditate regularly or not, which is more important, and which kind of, you know, helps or both draw each other and strengthen.
It's an interesting question. I was thinking, like, you know, everything has two sides, so it couldn't exist if it didn't have both sides. So in a sense, self-effort and grace are not two, we think of them as two different things, but they're not at all two different things. They're one flow of energy, and it just depends on, it's a peculiar thing because, and this is something that just simply comes from experience, from the perspective of the devotee, it's all grace. Because no matter how much self-effort you exert, when things happen, you absolutely know you didn't do it. You know that it was done by the grace of God. And then other people looking at you from the outside, I laugh about this, but it's annoying, actually. I watch people do it with Swamiji. He would say, "God is the doer." "Yes, but somebody had to be the instrument." "No, it's all the grace of God." "Yes, but you were there." And it's sort of like you're trying to repudiate that reality and everybody wants to paste it on you. But you know, if you've ever done any creative work or had a creative insight or had that moment, somehow the very definition of it is your absence. And so the fact, when people then want to make it your doing, if you're honest with yourself and if it truly is a flow of the divinity, you know that you didn't do it. There's just no question about it. You don't have to discipline yourself to be egoless. It's impossible. The truth is simply that it was a flow of grace. You can stand back philosophically and realize that grace would never have come if you didn't do everything you could to magnetize it. But when it actually does come, you realize even your self-effort was grace. So you get all confused with the words. Does that make sense? And it's all just, you just keep trying. Just keep trying over and over, and then sooner or later it all works out. Yeah. Huh.
What is the Ananda experience if you follow one technique?
Mm-hmm.
And continue to follow only one technique.
Mm-hmm.
Still we reach the highest.
Still the last, what did you say? Still?
Any one technique like Hamsa or Kriya or Om. Our energization exercise.
Right.
Can we reach the...
You mean just use one instead of using them all? is that what you're asking me? Master says...
No, something you love to do it. Something you say, okay, you don't feel like doing it. So which one...
Which is the best?
If we like one thing, we can continue to do that for very long and...
Master said that you have to do 1/100th of what he taught. If you only do 1/100th of what he taught. Now, I've heard it also said that everybody will do a different 1/100th, which is why he taught so much. But I think it would be unwise to decide in advance which 1/100th you're going to do. But let me say this quite sincerely. Swamiji wrote the book, The Art and Science of Raja Yoga. So there's those both those words. There's the word art and there's the word science. Science means that it's an objective reality, that, you know, it's a measurable objective reality. It may be metaphysics, meaning it's beyond the senses, but the chakras have a reality, the way the kundalini energy flows, the way the kriya yoga works. These are not made up. These aren't just somebody's poetic ideas. This is just the way you work. Just the same way that the surgeons know how the heart works and the orthopedic surgeons know how the elbow works. Nobody's making it up. It's science. It's objective, verifiable by experiment, consistent realities. You put your energy at the spiritual eye, certain things happen. You concentrate deeply, you will see the spiritual eye, and it will look like the spiritual eye. It doesn't look one way for Hindus and another way for Christians. When our friends in Italy wanted to make a glass art piece of the spiritual eye, and they were trying to figure out how to do it, he was intuitively led to this particular shop, I think in Rome. And when he went in to the man and showed him the design, the man said, "What is that?" And he explained it was the spiritual eye that you see when you're meditating. And this man, from nowhere, he said, "I've been seeing that all my life and I never knew what it was." I mean, he had nothing to do with yoga. It's just there it was. Now, that's the science of it. You're going to do better meditating here, sitting up straight, than you will lounging down and concentrating on your left foot. You know, it's just not going to work as well. It's just not. You're not going to get as advanced if you do that. At the same time, you're really different than me, and Keshav is different than you are, and Narayan is different than everybody. Look at us. I mean, just look at us. Every one of us made a very different body, different age, different realities, different temperaments. So where we're standing and what's going to move us forward is just going to, it's going to vary a lot. Because, you know, Serena is running a business and is raising children, and, you know, I never had children and I travel around and do this. I mean, it's so different. And Master says that's, Swamiji says that's the art of it, is that our particular painting has to be a reflection of our own inspiration, and will be inwardly guided to understand, if you want to talk about it, more Kriya, less Om, more Om, less Hong Sa, more energization, more Kriya, you know, Hatha Yoga, not Hatha Yoga, this particular mantra, that prayer, Babaji more than Lahiri Mahashaya, and that's the art of it. And that's also the self-realization part of it. And we have to become good at both the art and the science. On the self-realization path, nobody, on the self-realization path of Ananda, nobody says, this, self-realization. No, do these 15 things, you got it. It's like we have to become creative artists ourselves, and our most important creation is our own consciousness. So when you ask me, which one should you do, I have to ask you back, well, which one gives you the most inspiration?
Satsang.
Okay, then make that your number one. Yeah, because if satsang is what really keeps you moving, then make sure that your picture always include satsang. And somebody else will say, Kriya Yoga, 4 a.m. every day. And I'll think, 4 a.m. every day? You know? But for someone else, that's just, I mean, a friend of mine, just 4 to 7 every morning. She's been doing it for years and years, 4 to 7 every morning. It's just, you know, that's not going to work for me. I teach classes until late at night. It's just out of the question for me. So you see all of those things. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Can I ask you something?
That's why we're here.
You know, you have been on the spiritual path for a long time. Yes, and obviously it's true for them also. This is something, this is nothing specific to Ananda. The advent of modern technology, communication mm-hmm. technology, which didn't exist in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But then Paramahansa Yogananda went to USA. He drew large crowds, thousands of people, you know. Has the advent of modern communication technology, has it helped spirituality to prosper, or has it run into roadblocks in terms of other negative ideas coming in and making people kind of less spiritual? What is your assessment?
I think that modern technology has been a fantastic boon to spirituality. Di and I were talking this morning. We're listening to Swami Kriyananda's voice. We have thousands of hours of recordings of his voice and living movies of him speaking. And I can go on the internet and just watch him for days and days on end. And everybody, even as I'm speaking into this microphone, I don't know if anyone's actually listening, but anyone who has a computer could be listening to me right in this very moment. Perhaps my sister is. Hello, Beth. I just think that's phenomenal. And it enables the spread of these ideas. In our movie, Finding Happiness, about Ananda, one of the techie guys says, we think that technology is expanding consciousness, but actually expanding consciousness is inspiring technology. That the very creativity that's making those inventions is because people's consciousness is expanding. Here's just a piece of that. This was actually an earlier cycle when, now that I think about it, this was before 2009, but someone, when Swamiji was in his house in Gurgaon, somebody came. And he had been a young man, you might know the details of this, but some young man came who brought to Swamiji a message he said was from Babaji. And this man had been in the mountains somewhere and had encountered a monk. There was an inclination to believe it was true. Swamiji felt like it was a true message. So I don't know the details, I just know that he took it seriously. And the message was that the masters had extended Swami Kriyananda's life. This was even before 2009, because of all the good work he was doing. And that Babaji, in that time Swamiji was on Indian television every day. Babaji was, this was the message, Babaji was very pleased with all the work that Swamiji was doing, especially the television shows. Now, I immediately had this really funny reaction. But Babaji is, you know, is a sadhu up in the Himalayas. What does he know about television? And you know, that was just like, and then I had to stop and think, wait a minute. You know, this is an omnipresent consciousness who's presided over many yugas, not merely backward yugas, but also advanced yugas. And of course he knows about television. But you see how the mind plays games? But it was an interesting comment. Of course, we're moving into a new age. Let's use the realities of this age in the same context. And this is expanding from this, but because the Christian Bible is an, you know, essential part of Western upbringing. Jesus talks about sheep. He talks about kings. He talks about stoning people to death when they do the wrong thing. And he has all these. There's a very famous passage. If a sheep falls into a ditch on the Sabbath, wouldn't you lift him out of the ditch instead of waiting until the Sabbath has passed? And he talks about sheaves of wheat and the harvest. And you're reading all of that and like, you know, I don't have any sheep. I've never seen a sheaf of wheat. I certainly wouldn't stone a wrongdoer. I'm not going to petition a king. And so it all seems very esoteric. But in fact, Jesus was using the most down-home images he could think of so that the people around him would get the point. Then Yogananda comes, and what does he talk about? X-rays, television, movies, airplanes. You know, he just uses the everyday language of the world that he's living in, because wherever you are, you just have to see the power of the divine behind it. And none of it is right or wrong. It just is what it is. People have established great spiritual works in every yuga there is. But this one is a nice one, because it enables a global experience. It's eradicating space and time. Because here, the space you can shift over. Here we are projecting this talk out so that people on the other side of the world can hear it even as it's happening. So space is, the obstacle of space is just gone. We're in simultaneously all over the planet. It potentially, actually it's probably not, but in fact we could be. And then this will be preserved. This is why Brian is traveling with me. He's preserving it. He posted on the internet, and 25 years from now, someone could just watch us all sitting here talking. Time and space are gone. I consider that a huge asset. Now, in terms of being distracted from the purpose of life, which is spirituality, I think you can be distracted with sheaves of wheat or with iPhones, you know. I think you just, if you're going to look for God, you'll look for him, and if you don't want to, you won't. The form in which you're distracted could vary, but I don't think it's better or worse. It's also nicer, I mean, in theory, because we don't have, the world is not so physically heavy. We don't have to struggle so much just to get from here to there. We still have to struggle more than we would like to, but
you don't have to go out and kill your food.
You don't have to kill your food. You don't have to chase it down and kill it, right? You can just go buy it.
When you are in spiritual path, generally, the struggles become shorter. You want to formulate something. Earlier, say, used to take 2 years. Now it happens in 2 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So the concentration, whatever you say, are grace of God.
Technology really, I think technology is really a friend. Swami was always the first to get a new machine. I mean, he got a computer 1970, a word processing computer in 1979, I think. The Path, which was published in 1977, was the last book he wrote on a typewriter. Everything after that was a computer. I typed the path. I was his manuscript typist. I was very sorry when he got a computer. But of course, it was so much easier. He could write so much better and so much faster. I mean, we had to type and retype and type, and then he would edit, and I'd have to type it again. I mean, it just, you know, it was hugely arduous. Now you just shift it like that. You know, there's no, as Swami put it, there's no mechanical barrier to your creativity. You can just be creative in a smooth flow. The technology takes away the material barrier. You can create whatever you can think.
We were talking about just having guided meditations online. You know, people in the remote corners of India, if they have Wi-Fi, they can just be with an in a guided meditation, have a class every Friday night. Now we already started having online classes. I think Devendra did it last night. Mm-hmm. So we're only in a very few cities, maybe five or six in India, but this way they can also get master's teachings through Ananda Sangha, through...
Yeah. Where we are in Palo Alto, we've always been pretty strong on the internet presence, but we recently just had a meeting and just really said to ourselves, you know, we are not a geographically based teaching center for master. You know, everything that we do is global. We are sitting in one spot, but with the power of a camera and the internet connection, everything that happens can be global. Doesn't have to be local anymore.
Not yet. Coming.
Friday,
Coming. 7 o'clock. I have to double check. But you're not checking your email, are you? We've been sending stuff out about it, Vijay. But every Friday night, 7 or 7:30. I forget. 7:30.
Yeah, and guided meditations. It apparently really works. Every so often they have these global meditations where people gather in the meditation room of our community and they have a little computer there and they're simultaneously meditating around the world. I mean, a group, it's not just a public thing, but a group gets together, a group of friends of, you know, who all decide we'll all meditate together, and they do. And it works. I really have experience with Swamiji when he was in Los Angeles and various places, and in India also, that if I watched him in real time, it was very different than watching the exact same thing in a recording even a couple of hours later. There was a real transmission that happened. And so he would be sitting in Pune, I would be sitting in Palo Alto, and we were in the same room. Technology is the friend of God as far as I can see. Yeah. And yes, it's also allowing the dissemination of really horrible stuff. Really, really horrible. But it's neutral. It just is what it is. People were disseminating horrible stuff. They can just do it more efficiently.
Actually, the reason why I asked was, you know, parents tend to make this remark about, things are going bad because children are getting all this negative influence, you know, which, you know, we call it films or call it movies or whatever, or on the internet. I mean, that's technology too, you know, as you rightly said, it's got a horror side to it.
Oh, I think the moral standards of the world are collapsing. You and I were talking about whether or not we're in Kali Yuga for another 400,000 years or whether we're shifting from Kali Yuga into Dwapara. I take Sri Yukteswar's word for it and think we're shifting from Kali Yuga into Dwapara. And a shifting of the yugas is apparently quite a chaotic time. And the shift from Kali Yuga to Dwapara is the shift from form into energy. And through Kali Yuga, the form of things held and moral values, social order, obedience between the generations, dogmatic religions, all of that are Kali Yuga realities. We see them falling apart. Especially moral standards are just really disintegrating. And they are not yet quite replaced with a higher order. Swamiji says, but what's happening is, you see, people are choosing their own experience over the imposition of someone else's dogma. In the short run, that's very chaotic. In the long run, experience is a truer guideline than someone else's dogma, not merely because values are inherent, but also from the point of view of self-realization. Merely to be good because you're afraid to be bad, because the dogma says you'll go to hell, is not the same as actually being good. It's being afraid of going to hell. That's quite different than actually, as Master says, you know, choosing virtue because you find more joy in virtue. That's quite different. And before you can really advance towards self-realization, you have to make experience your criteria. You have to have the courage to have experience. You have to have the courage to trust your experience. You have to have the honesty to appraise your experience according to what's really happening and not just be prejudiced according to your desires. But all of this is terribly difficult on the next generation. I was speaking to my nephew who's in his early 20s. This was when he was in his teens. Basically, he's, you know, in America, whatever happening is happening in India's way, in America's way ahead of India in terms of completely destroying moral standards. I said to him, well, the good news is whatever values and principles your generation embraces, they will really be yours. I mean, to be fair to my nephew, he's an exceedingly honorable man with a deep sense of inner values, but the stories he tells me, has told me about his peers are stunning, just stunning to me. And I'm not easily shocked. So it's a fact, and the internet is making it impossible to protect your children from anything, really. It's as someone said, it's like all walls are permeable. You simply cannot set up. So these children who have chosen to incarnate at this time, this is what their souls need, are facing challenges that a generation or two simply didn't face because the Kali Yuga forms protected us. Now it's just completely wide open. This is the good news. This is the bad news. It's happening simultaneously. But I mean, just today I got a letter from someone who's, you know, just at her wit's end trying to force her son to conform to her idea of what he ought to do. And he's having none of it. And what can I say? I can't say. I mean, you know, the more she continues to try to force him, it's not going to work. So it's very challenging, very, very challenging. Yeah.
What about the stock market? Should we do well?
Not my field. I'm afraid I can't answer you about that. There's just no telling.
No, even companies, you work for them, they give stocks. So you should...
out of my depth.
Whether you should keep it or sell it?
I don't know. Should we trade or should we not trade?
I don't know. God is our stocks and bonds. It's a hard question. Swami Kriyananda's been predicting the collapse of all economies for the last 40 years, and common sense says they will collapse, but when is the big question, and how is the big question? Yeah, I don't know. Swamiji said it wouldn't be as bad for India as for America. As he said, we have farther to fall, and we have no experience in living simply.
Why all who love God should be protected? No?
Say again?
Why only India and America?
Oh, no, America won't be protected. The opposite. He said America's going to be hit hard.
No, the guys who love God should be protected. Not only Indians are...
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand.
No, what he says is that people who love God
love
be protected
God
wherever they are, whether America or India or wherever.
Well, that's what Swami and all the masters say, just love God and the karma is different. So that's Kriya is the best investment. And living generously and attuned for God is the best investment. And then after that, I can't advise, but use one's common sense, I suppose. It's not a field I know anything about. I mean, you know, one takes natural precautions, but it's hard to say. It's been a long conversation with a lot of people. Swamiji has been very strong about warning us and, you know, wanting to get us in communities and get us on the spiritual path. And you can only go so far with that, then. I don't know where to go after that.
But also, Vijay, you know, the people who love God, I mean, their consciousness isn't going to change whether they're in their body or not. So always the right answer is make sure your consciousness is as high as possible.
And if you love God, you'll be guided and protected, not necessarily saved, but protected, and you'll be able to help others. That's how I think about it.
In Nadi astrology, as when you go, you take out your past and you take out your present life, and they say that they can tell you your future as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do they know the future when I have not even lived my present life completely?
It's a fascinating question, isn't it?
It's been really in my head for very long.
Because if you're in a car and it's going 90 miles an hour in a certain direction, you can probably predict where it's going to be in the very near future because there's a certain momentum. You know, if it's, and so I think the principle is there's a certain momentum to our energy, and just as from today to tomorrow that momentum carries itself, you're identified in this body, you live in this body, your children are growing up, you continue with the interests that you have. Those are very gross manifestations of energy and commitments that you've set in motion that continue to play themselves out. And that even if you begin to make changes, there's still the momentum is going to move it a certain distance. So the theory of the astrologer's ability to predict even into the next life is that they can see all those energies on such a subtle level that within a certain, even for us that seems an absurdly long, I mean a stunningly long cycle, they can tell where the momentum is going to go. I mean, the book of Bhrigu is Swami Kriyananda finding his own life there from thousands of years ago. The mind just, you don't know where to go with that. I don't know where to go with that. I do have one theory. This is my theory of time. It's not my theory of time, but it's something Swami explained. I have to have something to explain it with.
What would you like to explain it with?
I need something that's a circle. That's a circle.
Yeah.
Okay, it doesn't have a point in the center is the problem, but it's all right. You know, they say, and this is just what they say, past, present, and future are all happening simultaneously. That's what they say,
yes,
isn't it?
Time is
an illusion.
Now. There's no future.
There's only the eternal now. So here's the circle, which we would call time. And we are somewhere on that cycle. Let's say we're right here. It's 2012, whatever, January something or another, and we're sitting right here, and each of us is in our particular body of a certain age, and we're deeply identified with it, which puts us right there. Okay. Now, some people are really deeply identified with right where they are. They don't believe in reincarnation. They don't have enough self-awareness to even remember what they did yesterday. They don't see any cause and effect relationship between their own actions. They don't realize that what they did yesterday, the fact that they were very mean to you yesterday, is why you're unkind to them today. Or they've been really mean to everybody, so now they have no friends. I mean, there are people who can't even remember that, and as a consequence have very little relationship to the future either. They don't understand that what they're doing now is going to create the future. So they're really identified with the most limited possibility. Others of us at least believe in reincarnation in theory. We have some self-awareness to know how our own actions are affecting us. So even though we're still essentially identified with this body, we have a slightly bigger sense of past and future. Now, the eternal now is right there in the center of the circle, let's say. From the perspective of the eternal now, if you look at it, you realize that every aspect of the circle is exactly equidistant from it. The present, the past, the future is all exactly in the same relationship to the eternal now. The whole thing spins around it, but it is completely stationary. Now, if this one, way out here on the edge, decides to start meditating or start thinking in a profoundly spiritual way, we start moving a little bit away from the identification of myself as Asha of a certain age, because every time I meditate, I kind of move away from that a little bit, don't I? And I move closer to eternity. And if I start studying these teachings and deeply believing it and getting in relationship to God, instead of living completely on the edge now, I've scooted over a little bit toward the eternal now. Maybe not quite to the eternal now, but I'm right here. And if you're right here, actually, you can see future and past a little more, can't you? When you're stuck right here, you can't see it at all. But from here, your perspective is a lot bigger. You may actually begin to remember past lives, or at least feel the reality of your past lives. You begin to appreciate that what you're doing now is really going to affect where you're going. In other words, you see your perspective has expanded a little bit. So you can project from that Swami Kriyananda, who can move so far to the center that all of a sudden he's equidistant to everything. At least as a theory, you can imagine that. Swami Kriyananda tells a very interesting story of when he was born, and in his childhood, he described the fact that, as he puts it, he was always a little surprised to be in this world. And he was in contact with the astral world much more than he was in the physical world, is really how he explains it. And the astral world was more real to him than the physical world. And that state really went on until he was like 8 or 9 years old before he really shifted. And he used to go to sleep every night. And I don't know, from babyhood maybe, he said that a light would appear and he would stare into that light, and that light would gradually expand until he was absorbed into it. And he thought everyone went to sleep like that. He thought that's what everybody was doing when they lay down and closed their eyes. And it was a long time before he found out that that wasn't what other people were doing. Then he said, much later, you know, he went through about the age of 9, he sort of entered a more challenging sadhana period, which didn't really end until he met Master. And then when Master, he learned to meditate, and he said he in deep meditation, he went back into what he now calls the superconscious state that he used to enter as a child. And this is a fascinating statement he made. No time had passed. When he went back into that, years later, it was the same moment as when he used to enter it as a child. Because in the superconscious state, no time passes. Because he's right there in the center. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
So what that all means, I mean, how that really works, I'll put my little coaster down now, but I love that. I've heard him talk about time forever. He put this into the Time Tunnel, the children's book he wrote. Or he said something that I was able to capture that. I've only understood that like last month, virtually. No, last time I was in India, that's when I had just figured it out. But it's fascinating. And now all of a sudden I can at least think about it. So you think if somebody's standing in the eternal now, it's nothing. They're as close to any incarnation as they are to any one of them. We think that these are all... See, we also imagine, and this is what delusion does to us, Swamiji was writing this, it's in Conversations with Yogananda, that for the creation to exist, there has to be the illusion of separate individuality. But it's only an illusion. So even the thought that you are a separate form over here, having this life, this life, this life, this life, and each one is different, that itself is a delusion. You are one continuous flow of energy. So if you could be known at any point, you could be known at all points. Because there's no break. This is one of the things that we think about in reincarnation. We think it's a break. We think we die. We think we go to the astral world. We think we're born again. None of that happens.
It's just one continuous flow. You're going to stand up from here and you're going to walk out the door. And it's just one continuous flow of energy. And in truth, that's what all of our incarnations are. So why would it be hard for someone to see the whole flow? We think it is, but it isn't really. Now, it's hard for me. I can just explain it, but I can't do it. But I can understand it enough to just see how someone could do it. I don't know what it would feel like to be able to, but...
And you could see when we do that, when we practice Hong Song, we talk about those pauses, that silence between every breath, the eternal now at the center of every breath, how we can touch that every day in our meditation. Now, we may not go into Swamiji's superconscious state, but if we're touching that even just a microsecond every time we do Hong Song, or even once a week when we do Hong Song, it's going to be transforming us, because if we're experiencing just a little of the eternal now in our meditation, and of course, yes, and we can just go back to that center, I mean, no wonder we start to remember who we are.
Yeah, exactly.
No wonder we understand the path even before somebody really explains it to us. I mean,
yeah.
You know, all of a sudden it feels like ours. It's like, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Because I'm feeling it, even if I don't know what it is. I'm there.
And you're much more relaxed, you know. Something happens in your life. It's like, you know, you're not living on the edge. So some little thing happens here. You just don't feel the necessity to become all agitated about it. Because you see it in perspective. And people who don't become extremely agitated about every little thing. People who live closer, even toward the center, have a bigger perspective. So even things like economic collapse and what should I do with my money and so on. Well, you just get closer to the center and it'll sort itself out. You know, whatever happens out here is so relatively unimportant. I remember when there was this big initiative in America against nuclear war, which of course is like, I think it's a good idea to not have a nuclear war. And they were trying to get Swami Kriyananda to throw the weight of Ananda behind this project, and he wasn't inclined to. And they came and they made this presentation, this group. It was a very sincere group, and they made this presentation, and they had this chart. And if the bomb falls on this city, they had a whole chart about how many people would be instantly vaporized, you know, how many people would be, there would be ash evidence of their bodies, how many would be burned. You know, it was just like this huge, horrible cycle of what would happen if a bomb dropped on a city, how everybody would die and how many of them would die and so on. And when they finished, Swamiji made two comments. The first comment was, even for a good cause, fear is not a helpful way to motivate people, because fear just compounds the problem. The second thing he said was, 100 years from now, almost no one who's on the planet is still going to be here. He said, whether we dribble off a few at a time over the next century or all go out together, he said, when we're in the astral world, it won't make any difference at all. I mean, these poor people were so shocked when he said that they didn't know what to say. But he endorsed their cause but wouldn't endorse it.
This Bhagavad Gita, Swamiji wrote.
Uh-huh.
He wrote it in America or in Italy or in India?
He wrote it in Gurgaon, in his house in Gurgaon. Yeah, he wrote it right here. I think he had to be in India to write it. Yeah, I think he had to. I don't think he could have written in America. He had to be in India. He wrote it right after he moved to India. It was one of the. He wrote it right after he moved to India, within a year or two of having moved here. You know. In India?
Yeah, in Delhi.
In Delhi, I'm here till the 30th of January. Then I go down to Mumbai. I was going to come back at the end of February, but it turns out now that I won't. So when I leave on the 30th, I'll be in other parts of India for one more month. I'll leave for America from Delhi, but I'll just pass through at the end. Yeah.
Only Bombay are you staying?
No, I'm going to Bombay, Mumbai, Bangalore, Pune, Calcutta.
That's what it is, yeah. In the last 4 weeks, so here and there. I'm not sure what the program looks like. I'm having a very hard time keeping track of this week. I can't seem to think it straight, but I have it on a piece of paper and I look at it every so often.
When can we see this movie of Swamiji? When it will be?
The Finding Happiness movie? Has it been shown here yet?
Only some private showings, which I guess you haven't had a chance yet. So I'm not sure.
There's no the promotion for it is going extremely well. It's going to be officially released in the middle of April. But the viewing of it among us is possible. I don't know what the policy is on it yet, but they're working it all. So if it isn't easily available yet, it will be very soon. We're working on a system where you can watch it on your computer, and you can order a DVD, and then we hope it'll be in theaters for at least a short time. It's going to be a big deal. Yeah, it's a good movie. And it's beautiful footage of Swami, just beautiful. Really, really lovely.
Showing the Canada school. On satsang days.
Yes, yes.
On a satsang day, I can't remember the date, but yes. The whole film was shown.
Some months ago.
A few months ago.
We've shown it here in this room before that.
Here also once.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's not quite just being shown all the time, because they're still working out the negotiations of exactly how it will be released in India. It was supposed to be released originally in the middle of February, but then they had to push it back a little bit. The actress, the American actress who's in the movie, who's the only actress, the only actor in it, the rest of it is just Ananda people, has a small role in what is turning out to be a very big movie in America. So her career has suddenly gotten all this momentum. So she wasn't able to come over at this time because of the Oscars in America. So it has to be postponed a little bit. That's very good for our movie.
That movie is opening here tonight.
That movie, American Hustle.
American Hustle. I can't recommend the movie.
No, I think it's an... Yeah, I don't think it's an uplifting movie, but our actress Elizabeth Rahm is her name. There's two very well known actresses, and she's the third. She's going to be more well known now. She's a very good actress and a lovely person. People take the roles they can get. This is a great career break for her, and I mean, there's nothing. My standards are different.
Will help to promote this movie.
You don't think?
Because, I mean, yeah. Purely from a media point of view.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. She is now a much bigger name than she was when she filmed this, and she deserves it. She's an excellent actress and an extremely fine person. And that role in that movie was a great gift from God for her. So we're very happy for her. And, you know, she's becomes a spokesperson. I heard her just, my sister sent me a link.
Maybe she acted so she got the other movies.
Well, it could be, but I mean, she was in an interview and she's talking about meditation and inner stillness, and you know, so she now has a bigger platform for, and more people will be interested in our movie because she's in it, so everything works.
So was Finding Happiness her first film?
Oh, her first film? No, she's a long, has had a long career, but this was being in this American Hustle was a big break for her.
She was known in a number of television serials.
Okay.
Primarily. She's what in Hollywood they call a working actress, which is somebody who always has parts and always is always busy, supports themselves. Then you move over to being a star. So, but she's a very, very, very good actress, actually, besides being, as I say, a good person and also having a beautiful face. So we'll see what happens. I'd like her to be successful. It would be good for her. Yeah. I think that movie, our movie, Finding Happiness, could be really a huge success in India, and I think it will really change the face of Ananda globally and easily change the face of the work here, because it just comprehensively and very persuasively explains what we're doing. But not in a narrow sense, not in a, oh, this is us, this is our path. It's more like these are the ideas that are the fabric of self-realization, and the movie is presented in such a way that almost everybody finds something in it that is meaningful to them. And the most, I have to say it this way, the most surprising people really like that movie. We've been sharing it around America, and it seems to have something for everyone. People seem to want something positive right now. And it inspires hope. The movie makes you think, oh yeah, there are solutions, there are good people, there are ways that we can be happier. As simple as that. So, we'll see. Next 6 months will tell. Do you have any other questions or thoughts? Well, what shall we do?
Well, we have food. We can always bring in food.
Well, food is always an option. If spirituality fails, then let's eat.
Well, we can continue to have spirituality, but it is there in case anybody is thinking about it.
We say, I have a question, but I'm afraid to ask it.
No, those are the best questions. Those are the best questions.
No, there's no time is there.
No, it's because since it's a closed session, so I'm kind of, I know it's being recorded, but still I will ask. Do you think, I mean, this is your personal experience or understanding, is there a religion which is like not very pro-meditation? Because I see meditation is there in, you know, quite popular in Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
of course Hindu religion, Christians go for meditation. Is there a religion that is not very tuned into meditation?
I'm no expert, so let me answer it from a slightly different angle. Meditation is the science of religion. Religion, there's a difference between religion and spirituality, and I think that's the first difference that has to be made. Spirituality is inherent in human beings. This is why the traditional word Sanatana Dharma is the best word. That which is, the eternal truth, the way we're made, we are a manifestation of divine bliss, and we are ever unsatisfied until we realize that. Self-realization is the definition of existence and the goal of life and spirituality. All true religions that are God-inspired and not merely created by some human being are Sanatana Dharma by definition, because if you're talking about eternity or infinity, you have to. There can only be one. You can't have two eternities. There can only be one reality that you're looking for. Sometimes religion starts as Sanatana Dharma and then devolves into being religion. It falls away from Sanatana Dharma. And even if the founding revelation was true, then the way it is practiced no longer represents the truth of the religion. So it has a core truth that has been lost because the lesser and lesser individuals have they just keep changing it and keep changing. This is why in the Bhagavad Gita it says that the avatar has to keep coming back. And Yogananda's explanation of his own mission is that Jesus appeared to Babaji. This is how the story is told, what this really means on the level in which they live. Jesus appeared to Babaji and said, the people who follow my teaching have really forgotten the core message. They serve, but they no longer commune. And he said, we have to do something about that. And so Yogananda is the result of Jesus appearing to Babaji, coming to the West with the message of inner communion that just cuts through all of religion and comes back to spirituality. Where I live, before we had the temple building that we now have, periodically we would rent somebody else's facility if we wanted to have a particularly big event. Well, we rented this local Christian church, and we used it 1 year for a celebration of Yogananda's birthday, and when we went back the next year to rent it again, somehow he'd heard a little bit about what we were doing, and the minister was less inclined to rent it to me, and I'm having a conversation, and he starts asking me a little bit about our teaching. And I said that Yogananda, our guru, I don't think I said guru to him, but he taught both from the Bible and from the Bhagavad Gita. This minister said to me, he didn't presume to call himself a Christian, did he? And I said, he most certainly did. I mean, who are you to tell me? I said, but he drew his inspiration directly from Jesus. And of course, he didn't rent his temple to us, his church to us after that. But it was just preposterous. How could he possibly own that? So that man, who knows whether he actually meditated or not, but he was no longer really representing Sanatan Dharma, even though Christianity is a true religion. This is just for fun. I'll tell you this story. There's a book called I Was a Monk by a man named John Tetmer. And he was an American man, and from the very young age, he was very devoted to the Catholic Church. By the age of 14 or 15, he knew he wanted to be a monk and a priest, and he went to a seminary and was ordained as a priest, had a very high intelligence, ended up becoming very highly educated through the Catholic Church. He ends up, he loves his life as a priest. Very happy monk, very happy priest, ends up in the Vatican and highly educated, wonderful. But he's working very hard all the time. He finally just exhausts himself with all, this is a true story, this is his autobiography. He just exhausts himself with all this work. So they send him from Rome to Switzerland to recuperate. He's absolutely forbidden to do any work. He must get his health back. So for days and days, he sits on the porch of this beautiful guest house looking over this exquisite valley in Switzerland with absolutely nothing to do, and he's under obedience. He can't do anything. Sitting there, he has a mystical experience, and he communes with God and he communes with Christ and is completely transformed. When he comes out of it, he realizes that the entire Catholic religion is false. Because he's seen what true communion is, and he realizes that the religion has nothing to do with spirituality. So the poor man is forced to resign. He has to leave his monastery, he has to leave the priesthood, he has to leave his whole career. And on that level, he's extremely sad about it, but integrity demands it. Because he was so educated in Catholic theology, he said most Catholics don't know the theology, but he knew it, and he knew it was all made up. It wasn't really an expression of the teachings, it was all made up. And then, here's the fun part. So he leaves the monastery. He ends up in Hollywood. He ends up being an actor in Hollywood, and he plays the part of religious people. He gets all the parts of religious people. It was the 1920s, and Amalita Galakuchi was one of his very good friends, so he almost undoubtedly met Master because he lived in Los Angeles at that time. And there's one sentence in his book, center everywhere, circumference nowhere, which is an exact quote from Master. There's no other reference to Yogananda in it. But I always think of him because he loved his religion and then he discovered it wasn't really spirituality and he had to leave it. So Master made the distinction between true religions, which you would say those who were founded by avatars, versus man-made religions, which were just founded by somebody who had a good idea. You know, in America, people can start religions. In most other countries, they can't. But in America, you can start religions. It's one of the quirky aspects of our country. And so we have a lot of really odd religions.
And then St. Teresa of Avila or Padre Pio or, you know, all the other saints, Christian saints that we know. So they were just moving towards the Christ communion aspect of Christianity and not aligned with, I mean, obviously they were Catholics.
Well, I would put it differently. their destiny was to work within the Catholic Church. Padre Pio was seemingly a great master, but he just stayed in the Catholic Church and stayed a priest the whole time because that was his destiny. That was his divine responsibility. John Tetner had to leave it because that was his particular karmic lot. But the thing about Christianity is there have been true, great, mystical saints in that tradition repeatedly. There's something real, very real, going on in there. It's a true religion, it's just not everybody practices it properly. So.
You have been very close to Swami Kriyananda. Could you tell some experience of his with you and some miracles?
Well, the greatest miracle, honestly, is it's sitting in front of you. I mean, that I am who I am and not who I was, believe me, that is a tribute to him. That's all I can say. Everything, absolutely everything about my life is the result of his. And just every day has been better than the day before since I met him. I mean, I wasn't a miserable drug addict or anything like that. I don't have any, like, really dramatic. He didn't pick me up off the street like that. I'm not Mary Magdalene, you know, saved from sin. But I was nowhere and didn't know how to get anywhere. And his patience and his wisdom and his just unrelenting commitment. And I'm just one of thousands of people. His miracle was, I mean, he did interesting things from time to time, but not that much. More than is known. I mean, I've heard more stories than some, but his miracle was just his friendship, and on a scale that you just don't even think of as possible. He was so patient, he was so wise, he was so absolutely committed to the welfare of everyone, and he never let up, and he never wavered, and I don't think he ever erred. He just stuck with you. And no matter what happened, he was just still there, just helping you out again the next time and so subtly, and not always just face to face, but just his energy was always magnetizing you forward. And it was very interesting because the day he died, after he came out of his meditation room, he went right to his computer and he checked his emails. And I heard, you know, some comment about his checking his emails, but Swami always checked his emails many times a day because somebody might need something from him. I mean, right to the last. He was typing his own emails. He was answering lots of people. We were always trying to keep his address a secret, but it was always creeping out because he was always giving it to someone and always answering somebody's letter, and then they were giving it. And then, you know, that we would get these emails, you know, please don't give out Swami Kriyananda's address. And then he would be the next person to give it out. and many, many people, you'd write to him and he'd just write right back. He'd never put barriers. He was always there to help you, always. And I remember when I worked as his secretary, which I did briefly, I did for a while, and then Keshava did. We were sequential in that position. I was very rough hewn, and I just really did not know. In general, I really did not know how to behave. But then representing him, he had to really teach me how to. And I tended to be extremely protective of him. You know, my job, I felt, was to keep him okay. And so I didn't always respond appropriately, and he had to make me understand. First, he had to make me understand that as far as other people were concerned, I was him, and that I couldn't act as myself. I had to act always as he would act. But I remember one thing that he said that was so helpful. He said, "You mustn't ever make anyone feel that their well-being is less important than my convenience," he said. And I've just always kept that in mind because I was always thinking that his convenience was more important than their well-being. He said that would never be my choice, that what I needed was more important than what they needed. And then he said again, you may not always be able to give them what they ask for, because not everyone is reasonable in their request. He said, but even if you have to say no, you must never make them feel that their well-being is not important to me, because it always is. Sometimes their well-being was for me to say no, because their requests were not appropriate. But nonetheless, it had to always be offered with that absolute commitment to his friendship. Speaking of that, there was another incident that I remember when he was in seclusion. And he was in a strict seclusion. He wasn't speaking. And I created sort of a personal mess for myself during the time that he was in seclusion. And I was hesitant to let him know the trouble I was in. But a friend of mine saw that it was sufficiently important, so she mentioned it to him, and so he sent for me. He wasn't speaking, but he sat at the typewriter and typed, and I talked, and he answered. And he said, why didn't you tell me? He said, I said, well, sir, you were in seclusion. I didn't want to disturb you. He wrote back, you insult my friendship. And I had to stop and think about that for a minute. He said that you would think that my preference was more important than my concern for you. He said, it's an insult to me. And, you know, that really captured my mind. And that was
something.
Multiply that by 100,000 people in 8 languages. And that, it was true. I saw it. You know, I was more on a day-to-day basis with him. I was more in touch with him than some. But he didn't treat me differently. He just treated everyone that way. Don't you think that's true? Yeah. You can say the same. Yeah. Keshava was right there. Do you want to tell something? That's what he did.
I can't think of a story offhand.
Yes.
I remember the first time I was still fairly new to Ananda, and I happened to be in a situation on a holiday with Swamiji. And he hadn't seen Jyotish and Devi in quite some time. I don't know, we were in a different country. He was living in Italy, not in America. And I had, of course, come from America, so knew Jyotish and Devi. I was living at the village. I knew how close they were with Swamiji and how long they'd been good friends. And so the phone happened to ring one evening when we were out. And Swamiji spoke to Jyotish on the phone. He spoke to Jyotish on the phone, you know, after maybe he hadn't talked in months or, you know, certainly weeks perhaps. And I thought, oh, well, Swami's going to be so excited to talk to Jyotish, and he's just going to, you know, I'm just going to really see what their friendship is like. And, you know, it was exactly as if I had called Swamiji or you had called Swamiji. I mean, it was exactly the same with everyone. He just treated everyone with such deep respect and divine friendship, not such a personal friendship. And I thought I would just see this bonding of years, that it would look personal. And it just didn't look personal. It looked exactly the same as any person that I had seen Swami greet, even the waitress at the restaurant. And I just really learned something that day. I just said, Swami treats everybody like his best divine friend.
You know, that reminds me, I had a karma when I lived at Ananda for the early years where there were two women in my life, one of whom I loved and one of whom I really couldn't get along with at all. And they were both in my life every day. And I was struggling to try to just sort this thing out. And, you know, this is an example of how confused I was. Swami's only been sarcastic with me maybe 3 times in my life, but this was one of them. Sarcastic was maybe not quite the right word, but I had this big plan in my head. I said, Swami, the problem is not so much, the reason I can't get along with this one is because I love this one too much. So if I love this one less, then maybe I'd get along with this one better. Swami said, that is the stupidest idea I have ever heard. He said, you know, the people that are very dear to you are given to you. And this is what made me think of it. So you can understand how much you can love. He said, and then what that's supposed to do for you is to teach you to love everyone that much. The ones that are easy teach you what you're supposed to do with everyone else. So that was exactly. So it's, I mean, that's sort of hard to understand, because of course he would love Jyotish in a special way, and he did, but it was his capacity for love that he was really showing. It was just effortless because of the karma between them, or who can say, but it was effortless for him everywhere, because he dissolved the difference. So, you know, you don't have to love your hand. It's just your hand. The other way he put it, though, actually, I wrote this in my book. A man who was very new to Ananda, or actually was just a visitor, said to Swamiji, he said, "I feel more love from you than I feel from my own family." He said, "You don't even know me. How is that possible?" And Swami said, "Well, I don't know you in the sense that your family does. I don't know all the details about your life. But this is what he said. When I look at you, I see within you the same God that I see everywhere, the God whom I already love." And that was a simple answer. Yeah.
And since we're talking about Swamiji, and some people here haven't met Swamiji, so how might that, you know, they might feel some regret for having come after he has left his body. So what can we say to that?
That was a setup question.
No, not really. But I just suddenly thought, well, maybe there.
Well, this is, even though Swamiji is completely off the planet now. I mean, his consciousness is in the infinite. This question already has arisen in a similar form for many years. Oh, the experiences you had with Asha, with Swamiji, no one I will ever have again. I'll never know him the way you knew him, which is a fact, both because he expressed himself so differently in the last years, what to speak of being accessible or not. I mean, he used to live in Ananda Village. You could just knock on his door if you get past me or Keshava. And then he was living on three continents, and then he was elderly and all these different things. But I felt, and I said it then, look, if his consciousness was limited to that body, first of all, then he wouldn't be the man that he is. And secondly, then this entire lineage would stop. And that's just not true. It's there's a power here that just has nothing to do with the form that it's in. And if the power is accessible, if the power exists, the power is accessible to all. So if anything that you hear about Swamiji resonates with you, or is, if you're inclined to believe it at all, then therefore it's as much an open door to you as it was to us, no matter what form you access that. I've certainly found, and others have confirmed this, there's no difference now, except he can't send emails. You know, there's a difference in that sense, and he's not going to show up and come in the door, and we would not be honest to say that doesn't matter. It was really nice that he lived for almost 87 years. Those were great years, and it's too bad in the sense of enjoying something beautiful, and you can still celebrate how lovely it was, and also just with a little bit of those were the days. But the essence of it, if it was ever true, it has to be true forever. And so it's really just a question then of making the effort. And, you know, you can listen to his voice and his music and read his books and watch his videos and you know, get to know the manifestation on every level. And then the part that really matters is how you feel it in your heart. So.
And on the other hand, now he's not limited.
Exactly.
To one body. He's not limited to being on one continent.
Yeah, exactly.
And in a way, he's more accessible because it's like his consciousness is more universal.
It's really true. That's not just sort of like saying that. It's really true. Ever since he left his body, he's just been more present. It was a limitation for him. I think it's stages of his mission, honestly. I think that he's just shifted into another stage of his mission, and this is the mission in which there really is no limit to the energy. We've all been, I mean, even those of us who know him well have been startled by the feeling of the flow of his energy and the work that what he's doing. I mean, It's just manifesting. We tend to feel, this is the question, self-effort and grace. There's just this feeling of Swami just making things work. In our community, we found and bought this farm, raised a phenomenal sum of money in a short record of time. And we just really felt it was, Swami had asked, the last thing Swami asked us to do was to find a farm. And then all of a sudden, we had a farm. I mean, it was just, went poof, like that. And it was exactly just the feeling of him making it happen. Like, you can't quantify those things. You got a center in Delhi. There's just a feeling of him making it work for us.